Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, journalist Joel Stein talks about his buddy Robert Goulet and publishing a mean joke about journalist Maureen Dowd and then trying to make up for it.
So I was going out to Vegas and I went to Robert Goulet's house. And we actually became really quite good friends. So he had me sit down and he read me that day's Maureen Dowd columns. He thought it was so great in the New York Times. And he reads it to me in this booming Robert Goulet performance. And I later wrote a column about meeting Robert Goulet in which I made a very mean joke about Maureen Dowd.
Find out what the joke was and how Joel tried to make up for it today on Storyworthy. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Joel Stein, and you are listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. And whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new fan, welcome to Storyworthy. I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week, which was...
What was it?
Story Smash, the storytelling game show. In fact, the one that you judged, Joel.
Oh yeah, that was the best one.
It was so good. It just went up last week. So it was you and Jimmy Pardo.
And Larry King.
No,
really?
And Eleanor Kerrigan.
Oh God, that's embarrassing.
You guys were so great. Honestly, the three of you as a panel, for our expert judges, because every month we sort of mix it up, and the three of you really, really did a great job.
Really? Do you think we should like do something together, the three
well,
of us?
Well, I don't know. Take it on the road. Anything could happen.
I hadn't considered it. They haven't called me.
Well, listen, you guys, go back and listen to Story Smash last week, because honestly, it is a funny, tight, one-hour game show. Especially that show, like I said, particularly, is damn funny. So thank you again for doing it. And now you guys at home get a double shot of Joel Stein.
That's too much.
You
should space these out.
And I'm so excited to talk with you because I hadn't met you before Story Smash, and you're so very subtle.
Does that mean that means not funny?
No.
That's what people say, subtle and dry. What they mean is not funny, which is fine. I'm not supposed to be in public. I'm a writer.
Okay, on Story Smash, okay, we're live on stage. Mm-hmm. You're sitting, and right in front of you, there's a clock facing the audience. And then we're going to the judges panel, and I say, so, you know, tell me what you guys thought. And you say, okay, the clock is right below you, and you say, I'm so impressed by how everyone can keep to the time. It's like they know the time.
But that's not funny. I was stupid. I said a lot of stupid things. I didn't understand that they were able to prep the topics beforehand. I was confused why everyone had a story ready to go on each topic. I felt like these were magicians because I didn't know about the technology.
Well, there was a clock sitting there. It was darn funny, and you were great. So I'm super happy to meet you, and I'm super glad you came today. And your story today you brought to the table is called Mishaps.
I'm not a storyteller, as you're
it's
soon
okay.
going to learn.
It's okay. Mishaps, I mean, everybody has them, first of all.
Sure.
So you're not alone.
It's a hap that's gone badly. We all have haps.
Do you really think that's the structure of the word?
No, I don't.
You think it's happening?
I think I've given you a false etymology to try and be funny, because I was told I was too dry.
Listen, I am so impressed with some of your credits. Now, you wrote for Time Magazine for
I live in Hollywood. We call everything credits.
Almost 20 years.
In my CV.
Is it 19 years?
I was there for 20 years.
20 years. What does CV mean?
Curriculum vitae. That's what, if you were an academic, that would be your credits.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. You're going to be learning a lot today.
I'm telling you right now, I'm going to start taking notes.
Yeah.
And when you started off at Time Magazine, did you have any idea in your head, I'll probably be here another 20 years?
Well, you know, no, but that was what people did there. So no, it didn't seem crazy. It seemed like you were working at IBM in the 50s. Like, people I worked with had been there for, most of them had been there for 20 years. So it didn't seem like a crazy thing to expect.
Yeah. Kind of like if you think of like CBS News or, you know, 60 Minutes, they're probably the same people that have been there for 30
years.
Well,
it was just a company that was sort of existing in the past in a lot of ways. And so, you know, if you go back 10, 20 years before I started, everyone thought they'd be working at a company for 10 years.
Yeah, I guess that's just the way it was.
Yeah.
And then you get your pension.
I have a pension from them still,
that's
I think.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, I don't know if it's worth much.
You don't get to collect that until you're You have to wait till
you're I wonder if it'll still... You know, Mark Benioff just bought Time, so maybe the pension still exists. I don't know. I should find out.
Yeah, you should, because you could be a zillionaire and you don't even know.
I don't think that's how it works.
Darn it.
Yeah.
Darn it, because that would be exciting.
I could be a pensioner.
Well, listen, you bring forth the topic mishaps.
Pensions.
And so I'm thinking...
I'm going to tell a story about pensions.
Tell a story about CVs.
Yeah.
Has anybody ever asked you, honestly,
a pension story?
Does anybody ever ask you about your college transcripts ever in life?
No. And I figured that out in college and didn't get particularly good grades because I'm like, when is anyone going to look at this?
And they don't.
When does anyone ask your major except on a bad date?
Here's the thing. That would be a very bad date.
Very bad date.
If they say, what's your major?
Yeah, what's your college major?
That would be super bad. But here's where a college education did matter, at least in my life, because I became a flight attendant for 7 years.
Oh my God, you seem like a flight attendant. That's crazy.
A flight attendant who smokes a lot of pot.
Yeah, well, they
That's
all do,
the
right?
No, I don't think so.
How high are you right now on a scale of 1 to 10?
11.
I thought so. It smells like a 12 in here.
We got drug tested when I was a flight attendant, so I didn't smoke weed for 7 years. How about that? That's an accomplishment right there.
So you could be tested at any moment, like your Lance Armstrong?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and it wasn't worth it. I mean, you know, at least they had us so scared.
Like you land in Zurich and they're like, pee in a cup.
Yeah, exactly. But they would say, Swiss V and Zwölf.
Wow, you can speak, is that Swiss German or Swiss French? That was very good.
Listen, my point is that I wouldn't have gotten
that. I can't believe you were a flight attendant.
I wouldn't have gotten that job. You just said it wasn't a stretch.
No, it's too perfect.
Ladies and gentlemen, Joel Stein is here, and he's going to be talking about his mishaps. No, but really, quickly, to touch on college, I would not have become a flight attendant had I not had a college degree, because they could use that in the interviewing process. I mean, if you didn't have a four-year degree, you weren't even getting interviewed. So in that case, like, I needed that degree. I'm not saying it mattered.
Wait, flight attendant on Delta, I'm guessing?
No. What
the fuck? It wasn't People's Express. What was it? American? Where were you?
It was People's Express. Pan Am. No.
Oh,
it was
awesome.
U.S. Air.
U.S. Air. Which, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, and it changed many
times.
Bought
by United eventually, I think.
I don't know, man. It's a long road. But
so U.S. Air would not allow you to be a flight attendant if you didn't graduate from a four-year institution.
Absolutely.
That's insane.
Why do you think that?
Because it doesn't correlate at all to being a flight attendant.
No,
that's ridiculous.
It's a very competitive job, though. And if
that's
you have
fine,
the choice, but if you can have the choice of somebody who got through 4 years to get that piece of paper, whether it means anything or not, at least you had the stick-to-itiveness to make that happen. You kind of paid the price. And so if they can narrow it down, why not? I mean,
I just don't know if that's the best system.
Okay, then
I did a training at Delta to be a flight attendant for an article.
Is that right?
And we jumped in the pool,
sure,
which was supposed to replicate what would happen in the case of a water landing.
Yep, and did somebody have a whistle and somebody sang the songs?
There were no songs.
When we had to do the overwater training, we'd all get in the life raft, which would be like in a gymnasium of an elementary school. That's mm-hmm. where we were training.
Well, they had their own at Delta, right? In
Atlanta. Oh, I bet they did. Yeah. I bet, because that's a huge, huge.
It's no U.S. Air.
No, what?
There's a reason Delta's still around.
Anyway, then the flight attendants, depending on which position you were flying, like the senior position or the B, C, D position, then you would have a duty. You might, if you were the C flight attendant, you would be in charge of the whistle. If you were the B flight attendant, you would be in charge of the first aid kit. If you were the A flight attendant, you would be in charge of the what did they call it? Not hospitality. They called it like team building. Anyway, you would have a songbook. I'm not kidding you. There was like a pitch pipe and a songbook, and that's what you were supposed to cheer everybody up. You know what I mean? Like while you're out
so
floating
British.
In the middle of the ocean. Yes, this is after you've ditched the airplane. And somehow, you know, the sharks haven't come around the site and you've somehow made it into the life raft, then you could sing camp songs and somebody had a whistle and somebody else had charms, which were like a lifesaver kind of thing, but they were called charms. And that was
in
case somebody was diabetic.
Oh, wait, can you do one of the songs still?
No, but because it wasn't like a flight attendant song. It wasn't like, we flew, and then we went down. It wasn't that.
That's exactly what I was hoping for.
It was more like, you know, like, let there be peace on earth, or, you know, or row, row, row your boat.
Oh, that's not good when you don't have any
Michael,
paddles.
Row your boat ashore. I mean, there was
those
all
are
these.
Better. I got to work a flight. Delta let me actually.
No kidding. And so you flew from where to where?
From Atlanta I think, to, back to LA.
Mm-hmm. It's a long flight.
It was a long
flight. That's your level one service.
I think I gave level one plus.
Dirty.
Yeah, a little bit. I remember specifically when you greet people when they walk on.
Right.
People are in that mode where they are like, I'm gonna endure this flight.
Yeah.
And they're in that survival mode where they do not respond to you. They're just in their own bodies physically. Yeah. And you're like, hi, and they don't respond. Yeah. And it's very weird.
Yeah, it is very weird. You get totally ignored, like you're not even
like,
there.
Like it doesn't happen anywhere else.
Yeah, it's so strange. You do. You get really brushed off. Unless it's a like a frequent flyer, you could tell who those guys are because they are kind and they look you in the eye. You know, or when they're leaving the plane, they say, nice flight, good landing.
I do that now. I respond to everyone because it just felt so weird. When you go.
That is. It's an odd thing. But anyway, my point is that sometimes you have to get through college just to get to the next place.
Just to become a flight attendant.
Well, and then I went to the Peace Corps and the same thing.
What?
Yeah, I know. Listen, this isn't about me. This show
is better. I don't have any stories. I don't like telling stories. I like interviewing people. You have
to
get through.
So in order to get that,
Where were you in the Peace Corps?
In Tonga, in the South Pacific.
Not a place. No one. That's
right. That's not a right place. Exactly.
T-O-N-G-A?
That's right.
But you pronounce it Tonga. Is that how they pronounce it there?
I think I just slipped my tongue. Tonga.
What'd you do in Tonga?
Taught English as a second language. Listen, the point is this.
Right.
I would never have gotten that if you didn't have the 4-year degree.
Right.
So that's what we're going back to. I forget why we even started.
Well, we just want kids not to drop out. That's what this podcast is about.
It's exactly what it is. Stay in school. Yeah. Don't do drugs.
Well, we kind of didn't. We went the other way on that, to be honest.
You guys, we got a great show today, and I am so happy you tuned into Storyworthy. But before we get to Joel's story, I wanted to remind you guys that you can listen now to Storyworthy for free, of course, on Google Podcasts as well as iTunes, right? So now it's on your phone. I don't care what kind of phone you have. You got yourself the Android or the what do you call it, the Apple?
You clearly don't have one.
The Mac?
We call it an iPhone.
I call mine.
You do have one.
A flip
phone. Oh, my God.
The point is...
I think you're up to a 13.
Is there... free. It's all free. And just tell a friend. That's what you can do for me. And the other thing you can do is join my mailing list. Head over to storyworthypodcast.com and it just pops up. I don't know how that magic happens, but it does. And then you can join me. Hey, let me ask you something. Do you play the stock market?
I don't play.
You don't play, yeah.
I don't play. Yeah. I invest.
Yeah, you invest. Well, there's a new resource out there that's blowing my mind. It's an app called Robinhood, and it's an investing app. It's right on your phone. It lets you buy and sell stocks. You can do all sorts of things completely commission-free. Here's the thing, is it makes the stock market not intimidating because it has a really simple and intuitive, clear design, and the data is presented in a really easy-to-digest way. And let me tell you something. I like to be spoon-fed my finances.
What are you investing in right now?
Well, I've got a lot of different things going on. But
very diversified.
I'm diversified, right. Definitely. And I've got some long-term situations.
Sure.
I've got some short-term situations, and sometimes I just kind of like to, do a penny stock here or there.
Do you really?
No, and then. So listen, you guys, you can learn how to invest as you build your portfolio. You can discover new stocks and track favorite companies with a personalized news feed, which is kind of nice. And they'll give you custom notifications when there's like a price movement, so you never miss the right moment to invest, Joel Stein. So you guys got to check it out. Robinhood right now is giving my listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. All you got to do is go over to storyworthy.robinhood.com. That's storyworthy.robinhood.com, and they'll set you up. It's really super easy, actually, and I got it on my phone, too. All right, you guys, he's here right now, Joel Stein. Like I said, he's a journalist who wrote for Time Magazine for 20 years. He's also written for The New Yorker, Entertainment Weekly, GQ, Esquire, Business Week, Playboy, and The LA Times. Now, you have a book that I happen to look into called Man Made, A Stupid Quest for Masculinity.
I'd like to look into. Instead
it's
of
so
read. I like
funny.
That word.
It's well, the I phrase. Looked I looked,
yeah,
looked at
into,
it and
you
it's
looked
so
into a book.
Funny and it's so self-deprecating and you really have such quick wit.
I have a gift.
You have a gift.
Yeah.
You have the gift of quick wit. And I listened to some of the audiobook and I like your voice as well.
It's a lot like this.
It's a lot like that, yeah. You guys can find Joel over on Instagram at TheJoelStein and also on Twitter at TheJoelStein. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Joel Stein.
All right, I'm here. I was working at Time Magazine, and I got a fan letter in the mail that came by FedEx, which seemed a weird way. No one needs to send a piece of fan mail immediately, unless, of course, you're Robert Goulet. So I got this FedExed fan letter from Robert Goulet, which was very exciting. And I was trying to figure out how to respond to it. And And I wrote him back, and then he called me. And he said, you know, I don't want a pen pal. I want a buddy. Be my buddy. So I was going out to Vegas shortly thereafter for an article. And I went to Robert Goulet's house. And we went to dinner. And we actually became really quite good friends. But at that point, I had just met him. And when I walked into his giant house in Vegas, and one of the first things he did was he said, he used to get like 5 newspapers every day. And so he had me sit down, and he read me that day's Maureen Dowd columns. He thought it was so great in the New York Times. And he had like underlined it and highlighted it like a homeless person. And he reads it to me in this booming Robert Goulet performance. And I later wrote a column about meeting Robert Goulet, in which I made a very mean joke about Maureen Dowd, in which I said, I almost don't want to repeat it. You can cut this.
Okay.
But what I said, she had recently broken up with the actor Michael Douglas. And I wrote that because he wrote so many wows in the margin of her column, I wrote that Robert Goulet gave Maureen Dowd more wows than Michael Douglas ever did. Not a good joke. Not a funny joke.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's mostly a mean joke.
It's pretty funny.
So the column runs in Time Magazine, and I got a call from this guy, Michael Duffy, who was the Washington bureau chief, who was friends with Maureen Dowd. Maureen Dowd had worked at Time Magazine, and then she and Michiko Kakutani and a bunch of very successful female journalists kind of left en masse because they didn't feel like they were given the right opportunities. So there was bad blood, and I had then made a sexist joke on top of the bad blood, which I didn't know about at the time. And she was furious. So Michael Duffy said, give her a call and apologize. I said, of course. So I called her up and I began to apologize. And she did this incredible journalism trick. So all journalists know that if you just stay silent, if uncomfortable pauses need to be filled by humans. And so as you probably know from doing this, you just let people talk and they will bury themselves. They make it worse. And that's what I did. I was apologizing. She wasn't talking. I was saying things I shouldn't have said and making excuses and just made it worse and worse. And we got the phone and I called Michael Duffy and I said, that didn't go well. And so the next thing I know, I'm getting a call from the editor of Time Magazine who brings me to his office and he said, let's send Maureen Dowd some wine. I said, that's great. Okay. And I was feeling him out as to whether I'd be paying for the wine. But no, Time was going to pay for the wine. So I thought this was a really great idea. And so he said, let's find out what kind of wine she likes. So he calls Alessandra Staley. Is that her name? The New York Times reporter who lived in Italy at the time, but was very good friends with Maureen Dowd, calls her in Italy, gets her on the phone with me in the room. So I'm just sitting there nervous and quiet. And all I hear is him say, no, you know, actually, really, he makes fun of himself more than anyone else. It's okay. And so he gets off the phone. He turns to me in a cheery voice, says, let's send her a case of wine. She likes American Chardonnays. Yeah. So I was like, great. So I grab a Sherry Lehman catalog. I call them and I ask them to put together a case. I spent a lot of time picking, like, I like wine. So I was picking California Chardonnays that I thought would be good. And I put together a case. And I get them to send a very nice note. And a couple days later, the case of wine arrives in my office with a note that just says, Mr. Stein, keep the wine, Maureen Dowd. So I was like, oh, that didn't go well either. And I didn't even get to keep the wine because actually the wine arrived on like a day when I wasn't in the office. And so everyone else drank it. So it's just been going really poorly for me. And then there was probably a month later or so, maybe more, I had the Stanley Cup for the day because I was writing a column and I was trying to do very stupid things with the Stanley Cup. Like I brought it to a pawn shop. I tried to use it to get me things. One of the things I wanted was a table in the, what was that place called? Not the Rainbow Room, but the Four Seasons. Sorry. So there's this area of the Four Seasons when at lunchtime, the front area, not even the pretty area, which was like the power area. Like everyone in media was there all the time. Very hard to get a table. So I just showed up without a reservation in the Stanley Cup. I was like, can you get me a seat? And the guy, Julian, who ran the place, is like, we sure can. So it's me and the Stanley Cup, and the guy who's in charge of the Stanley Cup with the white gloves at this table. We're getting a lot of attention. And this guy, Art Cooper, who is the editor of GQ, walks over. He's excited. And I sort of met him, and he said, I'm having lunch with Maureen Dowd. I said, well, I got a story for you. And he's like, don't worry, I will fix this. This is not an issue. So eventually Maureen Dowd shows up and sits with him. And I see them talking. I'm waiting to be waved over. And he's not waving me over. He's kind of giving me a look like, I'm not going to get waved over. So the maitre d' comes by, Julian, and I'm like, send a bottle of California Chardonnay over to that table. And for me, and I'm going to expense this all anyway. And time goes on. I don't see the wine showing up. And Julian's like, they don't. Art said they don't want the wine. So then I decide, because I'm a dick, and it's not going to cost me anything, clearly, that I'd have some friends in D.C. tell me whenever they saw Maureen Dowd at a restaurant so I could send over a bottle of Chardonnay that she could send back, which I probably did maybe once, maybe twice, which went very well. And I had this feud, this like wonderful, I mean, it's all my fault. But I was psyched to have a feud with someone much more talented and smart than I am. And that went on for a while until I was sitting at home one day and she had a book out called like, Do We Need Men or something? And I get this shirt in the mail that says, Do We Need Men? From Maureen Dowd. And I was like, and a nice note in the book. And I was like, oh, well, when people write books, they're really willing to make up with anyone. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Until I was at the Democratic convention that year, and this woman walked up to me who liked my column and told me she works for Maureen Dowd, and she, as her assistant, fixed everything and ended the feud and got me a free shirt.
Wow. Well, how did she end the feud exactly?
You know, the assistant convinced her that I wasn't as horrible as she had thought.
But did you ever stand in front
of her? I've never met Maureen Dowd.
Okay, so to this day...
I think I interviewed her on the phone afterwards and talked to her about it.
I see.
So I wrote an additional column about the end of the feud.
I was going to say, this is an amazing piece. It's a standalone book is what it is.
I don't think, no. It was a good 4 minutes. Doubt.
No, yeah. I think it's a whole feud.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is...
Well, it's over the feud.
I just can't even believe that you kept sending over wine in restaurants.
It didn't cost me a penny.
I just wonder, like, did you stalk her? How did you know?
I would say that, yeah, I should probably be in jail.
Yeah.
I wine stalked her.
No, but how did you know where she might be? You would just tell friends.
I didn't. I just had friends. If you ever, in D.C., I guess, is small enough, or I don't know.
Yeah.
I would just, it didn't happen much.
Well,
but I said, if you ever see her.
Is small enough, I would think.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's probably a big city. It's about the size of Vegas.
You are so funny.
I really am.
Well, here's the thing with all this time you've had at Time Magazine. You know, it was kind of like a lot of... you know, this denser reading, or at least more serious reading, and then you come upon your column, and it was like there was so much
easier.
Levity.
It was easier.
Yeah, so much more fun to read, and it was like candy.
Yeah, and that was a point of tension there, obviously, because there's only so many pages in the magazine, and they were going to waste one on me telling my personal stories. That meant someone else's story about like Serbia didn't run.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, so but still, I mean, everybody needs to flip to the fun part, you know?
Can only take so much Serbia.
I always say that. Every day I say
yes.
that. Did anybody ever take your place there at the Time Magazine after you left? And in terms of the column you did?
No. I left a little more than a year ago.
Yeah, hardly at all.
And no, I don't think the new editor wanted... I don't think he wanted a version of me that wasn't me. I think he just didn't want any version of me.
Yeah. Let me go back real quick. What kind of things did you do with the Stanley Cup besides take it out to eat?
I remember I kind of wanted... Conan O'Brien was huge right then, and I kind of wanted to work there, so I just showed up there.
Smart.
And met the executive editor. I met the showrunner there.
Yeah.
Who's still the showrunner there.
Yeah.
We had a foosball table, and we had a contest, and the winner got the Stanley Cup, I think, for an hour.
Wow,
we
that's
lost
so funny.
The graphics guys. What else did I do with this? I did a bunch of stuff.
Listen, Robert Goulet, that is a funny story. So he... FedExed you, and it came to your house or to
my office.
It came to your office, and then you open it up, and there's a letter, and it says, "Joel, I really enjoyed your article. Call me when you're in Vegas."
No, it was just I want to be your buddy. It was very vague.
What does that mean?
I didn't know. I thought it meant pen pal. I didn't know. I had gotten a it's very confusing because I was just a writer at the time. And I remember when I was first there, I was maybe 27 or so, I got a fan letter from Bruce Hornsby.
Wow, I love
who I
him.
Love Bruce Hornsby.
I love him.
And I didn't respond because I didn't know what to do. I was like, why, how, Bruce Hornsby doesn't want, in my head it was like Bruce Hornsby doesn't want me to bother him.
Yeah.
Well, how nice of him, but he doesn't, I just didn't know how to deal with stuff.
See, now if it was a tweet, then you could tweet back, you know.
Exactly.
Thank you, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, not, well, you know, it's not just the fact that Twitter exists, it's the culture is different.
Yeah.
Like, interacting with someone you don't know, if they're more famous than you, is acceptable. But back then, there were barriers.
It's like more tangible now. It's much more tangible.
You can get to people. Back then, there were, like, even as a reporter, there were layers and layers between you and them. And the thought of, like, bothering Bruce Hornsby. And instead, I seemed like a dick. Like, I didn't respond to Bruce Hornsby.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean,
I think so, for sure.
Listen, if Robert Goulet then, so you start up like a, but you're not texting him and you're literally calling him on the phone.
I wrote him back. I didn't have the guts to call him. And then he wrote me again and
he wrote you a letter.
I think he called me.
The when you got to Vegas.
And when Robert Goulet calls you, if I recall, what you hear is, I've got Robert Goulet on the line. Would you hold for him? And then you hear some music and then Robert Goulet appears.
I love that.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Do you ever get that from agents? That's my favorite. When I first got an agent here, that freaked me out. Because I'd occasionally get a call, and I was new to this whole world, and the call would be, I've got this agent on the line
for
you.
Hold for Denise. Hold for
the agent. And then the assistant would come back and be like, I'm sorry, I can't get him. I was like, you called me. What are you talking about? That's not how human interaction works.
So you go to Vegas. Ugh. And did you drive? Where does he live? In Summerlin? Or does he live? Where does he live?
That's funny.
Henderson. It's one or the other.
He did not live in Summerlin. He lived in Henderson.
So, because the homes there are so huge.
He lived
anywhere.
Right next to, maybe next door, or right next to Suge Knight.
Mm. Those homes are huge anyway.
Huge.
So I can't even imagine that kind of home. It's probably 10,000 square feet or 8,000.
You know, it was big, but it wasn't ridiculous. I know I went to Carl Reiner's house recently for lunch.
Yeah.
And what you forget is, like, before this enormous income inequality kind of existed, rich people's homes weren't audaciously huge.
Well, and they didn't make like the mega mansions.
No, if you've been to the Playboy Mansion, it's not that big of a house.
No.
The grounds are large.
Neither was Graceland.
Graceland wasn't big at all.
Let's just take it there.
If we remove the racquetball court, there's not that much there. You can learn so much about teenage boys by going to Graceland, because if you gave any teenage boy a bunch of money, that's what they would build.
They would. They would do Jungle Land in the basement.
For sure. We need a pool table, we need a racquetball court, place for my records. Somewhere where I can get laid.
Horses.
That's it.
And a fence.
Yeah. Are there horses there?
Yeah, Graceland had a lot of horses on it. Yeah. Well, I mean, that was probably four, because it's so small, like you said. But, you know, I went to Mindy Rickles' house, and that was her father's compound.
Okay.
Yeah, in Malibu, and it was pretty large, in that it was like a room beyond a room. Then you'd see another room.
John Rickles' place was huge?
Yeah, and I was looking around there, like, thinking, you know, Frank Sinatra was here. You know, the whole Rat Pack was right here in this house.
So I did these Q&As for Time, man, that I mentioned before, and I did one with Don Rickles for, like, Toy Story,
whatever.
Oh,
fabulous, yeah.
And of all the people I ever did them with,
because
I used to really meticulously write out these questions, and they were supposed to be funny, he was, I got done with it in about 8 minutes. He had a one-line, very funny answer for every question I had. I've never spoken to someone that fast.
Amazing.
He was so quick with it.
Yeah. His daughter, Mindy, she's played Story Smash with us, and she's super funny.
Really?
She's a comedian, yeah. Her club, she's mainly at the Laugh Factory, but super quick wit, and she's always thinking much quicker than you.
Yeah.
So great. So great. But I know what you mean. I mean, it was the Don Rickles place was big, but it's not like McMansion big.
No, I mean, yeah. Yeah. I bet my college roommate lives in, like, Alpharetta outside of Atlanta, and his stomach mansion that's just way bigger than Goulet's place.
Yeah, I don't think I will ever be comfortable in a huge place like that, just because I think I would be, like, scared at night.
Mm-hmm.
I would think about the heating and the cooling, like, who's going to heat
God.
And cool
have,
this?
Who's going to change those light bulbs? I always think about that.
I think of though, logistically, like,
if you don't use a shower for a while, it starts to smell because the gas gets trapped in the body.
Like, there's a certain amount of doors. I wouldn't be more comfortable with more than, like, two doors.
Also, it's,
like,
bad for a relationship. My wife and I lived in a studio apartment in New York City for 6 years.
Yeah.
A 475 square foot apartment.
Yeah.
And I was like, I always knew if something was wrong in the relationship. There was, you know what I mean? Like yeah. you fix things
it's
right
very
away.
Tangible, yeah.
Yeah.
Because the air is
in a big
is,
house. It's like, maybe she just you know, wanted to sleep in a different room tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe it's not me.
You can definitely feel the energy in the room, and you have to make it switch to.
You got
to
make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You really has. You have to do that. Listen, you're so funny.
We
Thank
have
you
so much
so
good
much.
Advice for people.
Thank you so much for coming over and talking about some of your mishaps.
Yeah, that's a great word.
You thought you didn't have stories, and look at this.
I still don't feel great.
You should feel
Sasha
great.
Sasha Rothschild got run over by a train.
Sasha Rothschild's story, I got run over by a train, which came out in July. Go back and listen to that.
I know her. I never heard
that story. That story was so riveting. The way she told it, she didn't have any notes with her. She just told it so straightforward
this
to me.
This isn't making me feel better.
I was literally like, no, but I was like fainting. I was like, can you get me the water? I couldn't even breathe because it was so stunning. But it's the story. It's all in the title. I got run over by a train, you know? Give it to her, Joel.
I guess. I mean, I don't want to get run over by a train. It's
not
worth it.
That's not the mishap you want.
No, you're right. You're right.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. Tweet Joel over there on tweet.
Don't tweet me. Why would you? Don't encourage people to tweet me. I don't want that.
Tweet Joel over there on Twitter at the Joel Stein. Tell him you loved his story and then follow me over there as
Leave
well.
Leave me alone.
At Storyworthy. And I want to thank all the sponsors on the show today. Really, you guys, when you check out my sponsors, it supports me and I appreciate it so, so much. One more time on behalf of the fabulous Joel Stein, thank you so much. My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.